Hello, everybody. Markets have been in tumultuous mood recently, but we're going to continue thinking about private equity and how public equity might impact private equity by talking to a real expert in the area who makes some interesting sporting analogies.
You know, the greatest thing around it is it's not how good it is when it's good. It's how good it is when it's bad.
Really?
It's like Gary Player, right? In golf.
So to find out what Gary Player has to do with private equity investing, make sure you stay listening after the following messages.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Brewin podcast. Me, Guy Foster, the head of research at Brewin Dolphin. We've talked to a few managers of private equity funds over the last several weeks. We're going to talk about private equity again this week, and we're going to talk with Jim Strang, who's today been nominated chairman-elect of the HG Capital Investment Trust. So congratulations on that, Jim.
Thank you very much.
You've got 20 years of experience in private markets and seven before that in public markets as well. So great knowledge of this sector. But I guess to start off with, it's a pretty torrid time at the moment for public markets, at least. Can you talk about how what's going on in the public markets affects what's going on in the private markets? What's the linkage between those two?
Yeah, well, probably I'd say the big distinction that I always make is if I go back to when I was a fund manager up in Scotland, that one of the hardest decisions you ever had to face as a fund manager was to know when to sell. And generally, you didn't for good reasons, because you know, if you knew when to sell exactly, then you were a party to information that you shouldn't have. And the private equity value proposition is you've outsourced your ability to make a bad liquidity decision to an insider. So you've lost the ability to determine when your money, in the most part, is liquidated, but you've passed it on to someone who's actually an insider and will make a much better decision than you will. So, you know, while you see volatility in the public market, as we've seen in the last couple of weeks, things are a little more slow speed in the private world. Because there's not really any daily trading in actual private equity.
Like,
everything takes a while. And that actually is not necessarily a bad thing. So it has, because of that, you have a sort of a resiliency to it. And that, I mean, that's really one of the things which makes it a little different, I think, is the private equity model, that the ratio of capital that we lose, as in it's gone forever lost, is actually a really low number. I'd say a 10% number is a rough rule of thumb. So for the most part, we don't have that left tail of loss. We have more of the positive skew, and that's one of the big differences, I think, between the two.
And would you say that's because of this sort of the fact that you're trading as an insider legitimately? I mean, I think when we look at, say, public markets, one of the things, or the interplay between the two, is often something like an IPO, where the public investors are required to buy something off someone who literally knows a lot more about it than them. I guess you're never in that position then, as a private equity seller.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a private equity selling to an IPO, I mean, that's actually a million years ago that I did a doctorate in that exact subject. So it is sort of slightly scarily close to heart for me. And, you know, I think the answer is that private equity exits through IPO is, it's actually a really small proportion of how private equity exits. For the most part, it's sold to strategic buyers or other private equity firms. So IPOs are a relatively low share, particularly in Europe. And then when it comes to the way IPOs perform as public companies, there's just very clear things you have to look for. And the interesting thing around it is generally they do quite well for a period of time.
But one of the root causes of public market IPO underperformance is governance failure. So one of the things that, you know, I look for when I'm thinking about these kind of things is, as the assets go from a private ownership to a public ownership, two things change. One is the governance changes, because the structures of the board adjust to become public companies. And the second is private equity is always really capital focused. So that they're very constrained in the amount of capital they allow these businesses to have, because that's how they operate. And when they go to a public arena, that capital constraint can sometimes be less. So you have this sort of combination of maybe not quite the same governance and maybe not quite the same focus on capital allocation decisions, and these things can come back to haunt you. And then the final bit is IPOs go in cycles. So there is a sort of a point in the market when you get more IPOs happening, and it is nearly always a more elevated point in the cycle, because that's what you need to support the IPO. But then obviously it's a cycle. So you have a combination of you've possibly floated at a high point, you've got a governance weakening, a capital abundancy, and X times Y times Z equals problem. So, I mean, that's what I spent 4 years and a lot of hours, dark nights, figuring out was that, and it still persists. I mean, I think that if you look at the recent stories, and there's plenty of evidence of it, it's still a challenge. So I think the answer is not all IPOs that have come from private hands are created equal, and you just make sure that you've got the factors that you need, and you don't like the ones that you don't have the factors that you want.
So when you're talking about capital there, you're talking about equity capital specifically.
Well, it's more capital budgeting. So, you know, what are companies going to do with the capital that they have? And how many good ideas do they have? And how do those good ideas that they have marry up to the capital that they've got to deploy? And if they have more capital than ideas and the governance isn't hard enough, then actually they will start investing potentially in things that are not that positive. They're destructive. And then if you get a value destruction and a levered multiple, then you're going to get a downside deal, which is maybe what happens potentially.
So, I mean, you described a reduced sort of left tail, a reduced
loss rate.
Risk from private equity. I guess people would think of it as an asset class which is very long on leverage and which can every now and then spit out a company that ends up having a balance sheet that doesn't look very resilient. But I mean, how much of that is a sort of popular myth or an unrepresentative sample of what is going on in private equity broadly?
Well, it's better than it used to be. So the record for leverage is RGR Nabisco, which was done by a couple of US buyer firms in the 80s. It's a book, and it's also a terrible movie with Robert Redford. Not Robert Redford, James Garner, I'm sorry. 98% levered. Now, that is a levered buyout, okay? Today, it's 50-50. So the average leverage ratio in a deal is around about half the capital structure. So the quantum of debt is a lot lower, obviously, than 98. But even in the last financial crisis 10, 12 years ago, it was probably one-third to two-thirds. So it's moderated materially since then. And then the risk in private equity is someone takes your company away. Because the value proposition around the insiders make the liquidity decisions only holds if they can make the liquidity decision. And the thing that will stop them doing that is they're enforced against through their debt structure. So the imperative is make sure the debt structure, there's not too much of it, and that the constraints that are within it, which is basically the covenants that are required to be met within the debt structure, are sufficiently set that you have a reasonable amount of headroom around anything bad that might happen to you. And for the most part, I think private equity is quite good at that, because it knows. It's a bit like saying, this is quite a good deal, but there's one thing that can really mess it up. And the one thing that could really mess it up is the debt structure. So guess what? That's the one thing they generally don't mess up. Now, it's not never, but generally they're pretty good at the debt structure. So that they're like the number of debt enforcements, if you like, is really actually pretty low. I mean, I'm struggling to think of the last one where we've had a real big debt problem.
So to be explicit about what you're talking about there, you're saying if the equity holders allow there to be too much debt, so we might logically think, oh, private equity, they want to get loads of debt in it because it inflates the potential returns, gives them an opportunity to take money out of the business. But what you're saying is that actually, whilst that incentive may exist, on the downside, if the debt's too much, then potentially they lose everything that was formerly their equity stake in a debt for equity swap restructuring type thing.
And what's become absolutely the sort of the game in town is it used to be, if you go back and see ancient history, the sort of classic way you would sort of create a value opportunity in a deal is you just buy low and sell high. So you try and buy a business for 4 times, 5 times cash flows and sell it for 7 or 8. Frankly, if you did that, you didn't have to do anything. I mean, I remember doing a deal 10, 15 years ago where the deal was an aerospace component manufacturer, and we made 3.1 times our money, and it made 84 million euros of EBITDA the day we bought it and 84 million euros of EBITDA the day we sold it. And all we did was buy at 6 and sell at 9, and that was it. Hero. Gone forever. Right, now the entry pricing for assets is totally different to that. It's much, much higher. And the language that you hear private equity talking about is this term gets used, operating full potential. And so basically the way to think about that is, you know, it's what does this business do day one? And let's assume that I've got a vision to turn it into something totally different. And that's day 1500, that's 5 years away. And what they're doing is figuring out what that full potential looks like at the point that they're buying it. And that's what they're going to achieve. Because effectively they can say, I'm going to buy 5 and sell at 10. They're actually buying at 10, if not 12 or 14. And what they're doing is saying, the only way, because there's only 3 ways to make money in a private equity deal. One is buy low, sell high, and good luck with that. Two is delever it. And actually the mathematics of delevering stops working when the prices start to get up to high single digits. It's just arithmetically impossible. So then you're left with the third one, and that is take something and transform it X to Y.
So this means ultimately improving the operational performance.
Take a business that makes £100 million of profit and turn it into one that makes 200. Sounds easy, is really hard to do, and takes a while. And that's the only way to play, really. And what you've seen with, even HG Capital is a good example of that. What you've seen is really good private equity firms have gone into quite narrow tram lines around what they do, because the amount of knowledge and insight that you need to be able to go from A to B is not something you pick up overnight. And you certainly can't do it across multiple sectors in any sort of unsystematized way. You need to have a model. So what you see the really good firms doing across the world in different geographies is, what's my repeatable model? So where do I look? What sectors do I feel have got sort of secular attractions and the right level of fragmentation and all the bits and bobs, and that I understand the fundamentals of how they operate? And then how many ways have I got to create value? How many playbooks do I have? And there's like half a dozen really popular ones.
Go and list them for us. That'll be really useful.
Well, the one that's sort of the obvious and the easiest is core business to full potential. So what that really means is kind of do nothing with the existing perimeter other than maximize the profit that lies within it. So that would be things like, you know, the customers that I've got, what share of their wallet do I have, and can I improve it? Right? Can I expand my customer relationship with existing customers? The second one is actually the one that is the most value accretive of all is pricing. Right? So most companies, slight generalization, many companies don't optimize price. They don't necessarily know where their most profitable products are, and they don't understand the elasticity of demand. And this is very, very pertinent to data and analytics. So if you have a data team, data science team, you can point them in that direction and say, what is the elasticity of demand? So good example is there's a business in London, a UK company. It's an automotive leasing company, has a very big portfolio of automotive leases. And they've discovered through data analytics that they could put a reasonably high single digit price increase through on every product and lose exactly 0 customers. And that's just straight to the bottom line. And they did, and they got that. So that's core business to full potential, share of wallet multiplied by price. Then it's the obvious, which is, how do I acquire more customers? So you acquire more customers either through taking share of a existing industry that you're in or existing business that you're in, or you acquire adjacencies to the existing business. And you want to think about, how much cost and customer sharing do I have across what I've got and what I want to buy, and the more the better. So these are called one-step adjacencies. So you do one-step adjacencies from your core to expand the perimeter that you've got.
Yeah.
Right, so that's a classic. And then, I mean, the other one, which is equally powerful, is rollout. I mean, the poster child for that is action. So action with 3i is just a massive, massive rollout. You take a business which has got 250 outlets, you figure out that the kind of theoretical max capacity is 1,200 outlets, and you keep opening outlets. And you just get the sort of increasing effects of scale running through your portfolio. And you just go on the journey. So Pret a Manger, Action, Pizza Express, you know, well-trodden path, pretty simple and straightforward. Only works in a certain kind of business, but works pretty well. And then you go down the sort of classic M&A routes. You know, we're not going to build out adjacencies. We're going to buy them. So we're not going to try and enter, you know, we have a UK business. We're going to enter France. Actually, you go, rather than do market entry, we're going to buy the French business and then integrate it into the whole, get the scale effect from that, create a bigger business, lower the marginal costs through scale, create value that way, off you rarely trot. And there's probably 80% of the value creation strategies have got some version of those three elements on it.
Is that the sort of the one that works best with the sort of fragmented industries and consolidating that, fragmented industries?
That works well, assuming you're not the first. Well, that works well, assuming you're not too slow to the game, right? So, for instance, lab testing, classic. So lab testing, we're all getting older. There's more and more of us. The amount of testing that's required is only going to rise. It's very inelastic because you're not going to quibble over your lab test. And it's quite a fragmented industry and it's defined nationally. So, you know, what you would see is several businesses of real scale in any local market, country market, and then a big old tail. So the thesis there is actually you want to pull a couple of different levers. One is you want to optimize what you have with pricing. And the second is you want to go on the journey of building relative scale. Because profitability is a function of relative market share. So it's how big you are relative to the next biggest player sort of defines your potential profitability. So what you want to do is build relative scale. And that is absolutely fine, but there just can't be too many people doing it because then you end up fighting each other. So what private equity would do and does do is go look at something like that and go, actually, you know what? There's good news and bad. The good news is we've fundamentally figured out how to do all this and the fact that it makes sense. And the bad news is we're fourth and we're too late. And therefore, we can't ever catch up. And so the goal there is actually to have the discipline to go, we've kind of figured this all out, but actually it's too late. We need to move on. We need to find the next one. And that's what you see them do is go, this is an area that kind of broadly makes sense, etc. But actually, it's kind of oversaturated, so we're going to try and do something else instead.
So there's going to be obviously some real challenges in the months and possibly year or so ahead, given the response of the global economy to the coronavirus, and it's going to hit some sectors particularly hard. Obviously, the ones that rely, I guess, on mass gatherings, travel, some aspects of retail as well. Is that something that I think we naturally assume that there's going to be some private equity assets involved in that.
Yep.
Would they be? Should we expect some negative headlines, or do you think there are kind of mitigating features about the structure?
There'll be some for sure. I think what private equity's tried to do. Has been to go for resilient, non-discretionary businesses. So an HG Capital Trust is a good example of that. So it's B2B software, business critical B2B software. It's not something you can turn off because it shuts your business down. Therefore, the flip side of it would be, burger joint, right? That is exactly in the sweet spot of consumer discretionary spending. And what you've seen actually is private equity generally doesn't do that much of that because the premise of it is it's too exposed to an exogenous shock like this, right? Because exogenous shocks can kill you, right? So an exogenous shock is the oil price. So if you're an energy business and the oil price halves overnight, then there's nothing you can do.
Whereas, well, that's a bunch of those rollout businesses that you mentioned that are in that kind of position on there. I mean, obviously Pizza Express had its troubles, but Pret a Manger's been very successful, but a bunch of those, I guess this could be the kind of left tail event that probably wasn't in their design when they were kind of deciding on the debt structure.
Yeah, although I think on, I mean, there's two things on that. How things can creep up on you. It's interesting. One of the very high profile private equity firms came and taught in my class at London Business School a couple of weeks back, and it was fascinating because I'd never really heard him explain it this way. But he said, you know, we're really successful. It's one of the most successful firms, and you know, you would think that we're all sort of feeling like we're invincible. Actually, we're pretty paranoid. We're pretty paranoid, and what you'll see us do most of the time is sort of sitting there going, what if we're wrong? What if we've got this wrong? What can hurt us? How can we get killed? You know, what can happen around, you know, if there's a massive turn down in discretionary spending, what's that going to mean for us? And, you know, for example, with something like a pizza restaurant, actually, yes, there will be, but that is, you know, that is relatively insulated, you would say, because it's not a big ticket item. It's a bit like in the beauty industry, in a downturn, lipstick sales go up. Right, because it's affordable luxury, and that's a good thing in a downturn. People want that. So it's not that they're all created the same. So the first thing they'll go through is go, well, actually, how much of this stuff did we create in the first place? The second is, what can we do as a sort of mitigating step to the operating model? And in something like a rollout strategy, the simple thing you do is you stop rolling it out. And you stop rolling it out, then it has a sort of changes the cash flow profile, because you're not spending all your free cash flow opening new stores. You can reinvest it back where you've got, or you can just survive in a more difficult time. And the third is obviously around the capital structure, which is, you know, this is the kryptonite of private equity, is the capital structure. So the groups now all have banking groups whose jobs are just to sit there and continually optimize around how could we go wrong? What's the paranoia factor? How could we get this wrong? What if we're wrong? To make sure they don't get caught by debt enforcement. And then on debt enforcement, there's a few things that are also helping on that. One is, in the last cycle in the UK, I mean, private equity is predominantly financed by banks. And banks had covenants, and they were pretty good at enforcing them.
Yeah.
Number of banks lending to UK private equity has gone from over 20 to less than 5. And what's coming into place are two things. One is high yield bonds, and high yield bonds don't have covenants. And the second is loan fund financing. And loan funds do have covenants, but they're not quite the same. So that, again, the sort of big scary risks around capital structure, not quite what they used to be. Still there, and still a source of terror, but not the visceral terror that there was the last go around.
So what's the difference then between the kind of loan fund covenants that you'd be working under now and the banking covenants that would have imperiled private equity holders?
Yeah. Well, you normally had, on the classic banking side, you normally had sort of three major covenants which were around. So one was sort of total debt, one was a EBITDA covenant, and one was a cash flow covenant that would be baked in. And the way that the banks used to operate was you would set a business case in your business plan, which is obviously what you use to get the deal done, and then you'd have a banking case which would still be a positive growth trajectory but not quite the same as a business case. So say 15% below. And what you would be negotiating with the banks would be, you know, A, are they going to give you the money? B, are they going to give you on terms which are sort of broadly acceptable to you? And C, what does the covenant package look like, both in terms of the way it was formed and the amount of room you had? Because clearly, I mean, if what you would want to do is have a country mile between the business case and the banking case.
Yeah.
So you had a huge sort of window to operate within. And what they'd obviously be trying to do is narrow it down. So you would get into a combination of what kind of deal can you get, both on the price of the different debt tranches, because there's normally three, or the difference between the banking case and the business case to give you the headroom. Because what would happen, off you'd merrily sail, and you could get, you know, not impossibly, you could have a wobble in a year or two, and you just don't make that banking case, and it becomes a technical default. So you're still paying interest, you're still doing everything you need to do, but you've technically defaulted. And then, you know, the bank would want to talk to you about how to resolve that default, and that would normally be an expensive trip to the bank, but nothing fundamentally different. Loan funds, slightly different. So generally, it's more flexible.
And how would that be resolved then? Paying a higher rate or?
Normally a penalty, some kind of penalty.
So they're not typically wanting to take any equity off you?
Well, not at that point, because to some extent, the last thing they want is, and this is, again, one of the big differences between
back then, potentially now, is that back then the banks had restructuring groups. So if a business really went into sort of distress, then the bank had real teeth, because it could say, well, look, we can enforce and we can pass this to our restructuring division who'll manage out our position and we'll see how we go. Loan funds don't have restructuring groups. They just don't have them. They don't exist. So, you know, the thesis is that, well, A, the structure of their lending is generally not as difficult or as challenging as it would have been in a bank 10, 15 years ago. And two, they don't really have any workout capability. So what they're going to be interested in doing is keeping things going and actually helping. They'll be arguably more willing to support the sponsor to run through whatever the challenges are than they will be to enforce against it, because they don't really have a mechanism for that or the people to do it.
And so you mentioned the loan funds and the high yield bonds and the banks. Obviously, we've got a burgeoning private debt market as well. So is that...
Those are loan funds.
That's the same source of funding, ultimately.
Yeah, private debt is delivered by loan funds, primary lending funds.
Okay. And the weakness of the covenants in that area, then, is to the equity holders' benefit? And how does it change the outlook, then, I guess, for private debt holders?
Well, I think a couple of things. On private debt, so the people that have been issuing the bank loans to replace the banks, I mean, generally, there's been a huge increase in the number of funds that do that. So it's gone from almost none to actually probably now, pick a number, 100 or more. So there's lots and lots of places to go. Also, when deals get done, debt advisory operations, which there are many, will work with the private equity firms to go, how do we figure out the optimum place to go for this deal? What does it look like? So, and depending on the full potential plan, it'll need a different structure. Because some will need a load of flexibility because they're going to be very cash consumptive to deliver their transformation. Others maybe a bit less so. And that all jives back to what kind of debt structure you need. So which method do you want? And is it big enough to go to the bond market? Do you want loan funds with unitranche structure, so one mixed structure? Do you want layers in different debt tranches? You know, there's a million different ways to solve it. The issue with debt being, or rather terms being a little bit more lenient potentially, is it definitely changes the risk position of private equity, for sure. So it gives them...
Reduces the risk for the equity holder.
Yeah, because if you think, like, the number one risk is somebody takes your company away, and the way that really happens is the company gets enforced against by its credit, and the credit's not able to do that to the same extent because the structures are fundamentally different, then that's reduced the risk.
Yeah.
Boom. And then also the other thing is that, as we said, the quantum of leverage, or rather the amount of leverage relative to the amount of equity in the deals, is much higher than it used to be. And that's actually good news for securing that equity position, but bad news for generating a return on that equity, because effectively it's less levered equity. It's a bit like saying, you know, if you put 50% deposit down on your house, you know, if the value of your house doubles, then your return per dollar or pound that you put into the house looks very different if you put 10% down. Just the math. So, you know, therefore you have to be even more sure about what you're going to do with the business that you're buying, because you've actually got less of a levered equity position than you would have done 10, 20 years ago. So,
and is that really what's happening then? So leverage levels ratios in deals is generally lower.
Yeah. Yeah.
Despite how cheap it is.
Yeah. So well, you've got to be careful. The ratio of leverage is much more in balance. So as I said earlier, it used to be, you know, very thin equity and very thick debt in a deal structure. Now you've got much more equilibrium. So it's more like 50-50 debt to equity. It's still a lot of leverage, don't get me wrong, because the equilibrium multiple for deals has just done nothing but rise. So, you know, people always talk about, you know, private equity is a big scary industry. The global private equity industry, everything, everywhere, if it was an asset manager, it would be the fourth. So it's about a $6 trillion industry. Public bond and equities is about $180 trillion, or it was until a couple of weeks ago. So actually, we're tiny. The amount of capital that's raised, we all raise money 5 years in advance. So there's always more money out there, if you like, on standby than would be invested in any 1 year. But if you look at the machine, the pace of the machine that's investing, it's actually investing at exactly the equilibrium rate that it's always invested at. So the private equity industry is doing as much investing as it's ever done on a relative basis, except the numbers keep getting bigger. And the thing, and you know, the obvious thing is what's given, because something has to have given. And the answer is the pricing is given. So the pricing has just risen. So in that environment, you've seen more equity go in and more debt go in, but the ratio has normalized a bit. So there's almost as much equity as debt.
Okay, and then the other, you know, just finally, the other piece of news, I guess, this week started with the news about the collapse in the oil price, the collapse of any discipline in the OPEC plus markets.
Yep.
I know this is another area where there are private equity funds at work. What kind of assets, what kind of involvement does private equity have in the energy market?
Lots. And it's very disparate as well. So you've got upstream, midstream, downstream. So you have all the classic hard asset type exposures. So everything from holes in the ground in West Texas to LNG plants in the Savannah River to obviously sort of forecourt retailing of petrochemicals. So you have a whole bunch upstream, downstream, midstream, and then you have all the supporting businesses that are around about them. So well testing companies and even recruitment businesses that specialize in oil and gas. So there's a enormous value chain that you can go and play around in, and private equity's kind of got bits of everything.
And funds dedicated to
not so much in Europe, far fewer here. There's only really a handful, many more in the States, where there's a real plethora and in all kinds of shapes and forms. There's going to be an effect. There just has to be. The other question, of course, is there's an awful lot of private equity in energy, but there's also an awful lot of private debt in energy. So, you can go at this both sides of the equation, basically. And the volatility will be pretty telling for them.
What is it that leads an oil asset to end up in private hands rather than in one of the sort of mega public oil and gas companies?
Well, it's normally the hard asset end. So someone drilling a hole in the ground, basically. And it can be,
but beyond it, like once they know there's something underneath it.
But I think my sense in it, I mean, I'm not a huge expert in it, but my sense from what I've seen from our business is more they don't want to take the E&P risk. So if there's a way to get more proven reserves on somebody else's dollar, then actually it's a better trade to do that rather than invest in that yourself. It's a bit analog to what Big Pharma does now. It doesn't do primary R&D to the same extent it used to do, because you can kind of outsource that, and actually net-net is still an economically sensible decision to do that. There's a bit of that.
Right.
There's a bit of that. And so if you can bundle up private equity
would be more E&P, more exploration.
It's got everything.
Yeah.
It goes everywhere, but you tend to have more, I'd say, it's a very fragmented market. There's an awful lot of groups that will raise small pools of capital to do specific projects. And you'll find a group that, we know the northeast corner of the Bakken field like nobody else, and we've got a way to make money out of it.
Right.
You'll get that. But then you'll get also, the one of the biggest deals done was done by Blackstone, and it's an LNG facility. It's an enormous gas plant. So that's also in the energy space, but it's a totally different, the business economics of that look very different to digging a hole in the ground. And then obviously the real downstream end of it is much closer to the consumer. And people play that as well. I mean, there's people own large chunks of petrol stations. So like someone in London's got a big chunk of petrol stations. So you can play it that way as well.
So just like two things then before we finish. What's the biggest opportunity area and what's the biggest risk in private markets from your perspective?
Biggest opportunity, I think, I would say the greatest thing around it is it's not how good it is when it's good. It's how good it is when it's bad.
Really?
It's like Gary Player, right? In golf. Because it has this real resiliency to the downside. So, if you go to your average investor and say, look, here's an asset class which is actually very skewed to the upside, right? With very little downside, that's a pretty appealing value proposition. And that's basically the private equity value proposition, which is why, it's $6 trillion out of $180 trillion. I'm guarantee you it's going to grow. The downside of it, the worst that could happen, I think it's still terribly badly understood and it's opaque. So people still don't, I think, fully trust it because they don't, I think, understand exactly how plumbing all works, and I don't blame them because it's not very obvious outside in. And it's different. It's different. I go back to my very early career when I was fund manager up in Scotland. You know, it's apples and bananas. It really is. And it's not easy to make the crossover. So it's difficult to build people's confidence and conviction that it's a good thing for them. And ultimately that's on us to make sure that we come across as transparent and straightforward, and we can articulate what we're doing in a way that makes it make sense, or else we won't get very far.
Okay, well, I mean, hopefully our modest series of podcasts might help to some extent with that understanding process. But Jim, thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy day to take us through that tour of the private equity world. And thanks to all our listeners. We hope that you will be able to find the time again to listen to the next Bruin podcast.